The instructions were necessary, and then they were not. Jake, Portia, and Lucian had rehearsed with Letty for hours in the conference room at the office. She was well prepared, though in a deposition it was impossible to predict what might be discussed. At trial, all testimony must be relevant, not so in a deposition, which often turned into a prolonged fishing expedition. Be polite, be concise, don't volunteer. If you don't know, then you don't know. Remember, the camera catches everything, and I'll be right beside you for protection, Jake had said over and over. Portia had gone to the attic and found dozens of old depositions that she had spent hours poring over. She understood the technicalities, the strategies, and the pitfalls. She and her mother had talked for hours on the back porch of the old Sappington house. Letty was as prepared as possible. After she was sworn by the court reporter, Wade Lanier introduced himself with a sappy smile and began the questioning.
Let's start with your family, he said.
Names, current residences, birth dates, birthplaces, education, employment, children, grandchildren, parents, brothers, sisters, cousins, aunts, uncles. Letty and Portia had rehearsed thoroughly, and the answers came easily. Lanier paused at one point when he realized Portia was her daughter. Jake explained, "She's an intern in my office, paid." This caused some concern around the table. Stillman Rush finally asked,
"Does this pose a conflict, Jake?"
Jake had thought it over long ago.
"Not at all. I represent the estate. Portia is not a beneficiary under the will. I see no conflict, do you?"
"Is she going to be a witness?" Lester Chilcott asked.
"No, she was away in the Army for the past 6 years.
Zach Zeitler asked,
"Will she have access to certain information her mother perhaps should not see?"
"Such as?"
"I can't give you an example right now. I'm just speculating. I'm not saying there's a conflict here, Jake. I'm just sort of caught off guard."
"Have you informed Judge Attlee?" Wade Lanier asked.
"I did last week, and he approved." End of conversation. Wade Lanier took off again with questions about Letty's parents and grandparents. His questions were soft and easy, quite conversational, as if he were truly interested in where her maternal grandparents once lived and what they did for a living. After an hour, Jake fought the temptation to daydream. It was important for him to take notes in the event another lawyer, hours from now, inadvertently stepped into the same territory. Back to Letty. She finished high school in 1959 in Hamilton, Alabama, at the old colored school. She ran away to Memphis and met Simeon. They married right away, and Marvis was born the following year. Wade Lanier spent some time on Marvis, his criminal record, convictions, incarceration. Letty got choked up and wiped her cheeks, but did not break down. Next came Fidra and her problems. Two children born out of wedlock, Letty's first two grandkids, an employment history that was sketchy at best. Fidra was currently living at home. In fact, she'd never really left. Her two children had different fathers who were out of the picture. Portia flinched with questions about her older brother and her sister. These were not secrets, but they were not openly discussed either. The family whispered about such matters, yet here they were being kicked about by a bunch of white men, strangers all. At 10:30, they broke for 15 minutes, and everyone scattered. The lawyers ran to find phones. Portia and Letty headed for the ladies' room. A clerk brought in a fresh pot of coffee and a tray of store-bought cookies. The tables already resembled a landfill. When they resumed, Stillman Rush took the handoff and dwelled on Simeon.
whose family was more complicated. Letty admitted she did not know as many details about his ancestors. His work history was filled with gaps, but she did recall stints as a truck driver, dozer operator, pulpwood cutter, painter, and brick mason's helper. He had been arrested a couple of times, the most recent being last October. Misdemeanors, no felonies. Yes, they had separated several times, but never for more than 2 months. Enough of Simeon, for now anyway. Stillman wanted to follow up with Letty's resume. She worked for Seth Hubbard off and on, part-time and full-time, for most of the past 3 years. Before that, she worked for 3 years as a housekeeper in the Clanton home of an old couple Jake had never heard of. Both died within 3 months of one another, and Letty was out of work. Before that, she worked as a cook in the middle school cafeteria in Caraway. Stillman wanted dates, wages, raises, bosses, every minute detail, and Letty did the best she could. Seriously? Portia asked herself. How could the name of my mother's boss 10 years ago possibly be important to this will contest? It would be a fishing expedition, Jake had said. Welcome to the mind-numbing dullness of deposition warfare. Jake had also explained that depositions drag on for days because the lawyers are being paid by the hour, or at least the ones who are asking the banal and monotonous questions. With virtually no restrictions on what can be explored, and with their meters running, lawyers, especially those working for insurance companies and big corporations, have no interest in being concise. As long as they can keep the conversation close to a person, issue, or thing remotely connected to the lawsuit, then they can peck away for hours. However, Jake had also explained that the Hubbard case was different because the only lawyer working by the hour was him. The others were there on a prayer and a percentage. If the handwritten will were to be invalidated, the money would revert to the family under the prior will, and all those lawyers would take a cut. Since the other lawyers had no guarantee they would be paid, he suspected their questions might not be so tedious. Portia wasn't so sure about that. Tedium was closing in from all directions. Stillman liked to bounce around, probably in an effort to keep the witness off balance. He woke up the crowd with, "Now, did you borrow money from your former attorney, Booker Sistrunk?"
"I did."
Letty knew the question was coming and answered it without hesitation. There was no law or rule against such a loan, not on the receiving end, anyway.
"How much?"
$50,000.
"Did he write you a check or was it in cash?"
"Cash, and we, Simeon and I, signed a promissory note."
"Was this the only loan from Sis Trunk?"
"No, there was a prior loan for $5,000.
"Why did you borrow money from Mr. Sis Trunk?"
"Because we needed the money. I lost my job, and with Simeon, you never know."
"Did you take the money and move into a larger house?"
"We did."
"And how many people now live in that house?"
Letty thought for a moment and said,
"Usually around 11, but the number varies. Some come and go."
Jake glared at Stillman as if to say, "Don't even think about wanting all 11 names. Can we just move along?" Stillman was tempted, but moved along.
"How much are you paying in rent?"
$700 a month.
"And you're unemployed as of today?"
"Correct."
"Where's your husband working right now?"
"He's not."
"Since Mr. Sistrunk is no longer your lawyer, how do you plan to repay him?"
"We'll worry about that later."
Roxy had sandwiches and chips ready for lunch, and they ate in the conference room where Lucian joined them.
"How'd it go?" he asked.
The usual first round of worthless questions, Jake said. Letty was great, but she's already tired. Letty said,
I can't do this for another day and a half.
Modern discovery, Lucian said in disgust. Tell us how it was back in the old days, Lucian, Jake said.
Well, back in the old days, and the old days were much better than all these new rules you got now.
I didn't write them.
You weren't required to divulge all your witnesses and describe what they were going to say. No, sir. It was trial by ambush. You get your witnesses, I'll get mine, and we'll show up at the courthouse and have us a trial. It made you a better lawyer, too, because you had to react on the fly. Nowadays, everything has to be fully disclosed and every witness has to be available for a deposition. Think of the time. Think of the expense. It was far better back then. I swear it was.
Why don't you take a large bite of that sandwich, Jake said. Letty needs to relax, and no one can relax when you're on your soapbox. Lucian took a small bite and asked,
What'd you think, Portia?
She was nibbling on a chip. She laid it down and said,
It's pretty cool. I mean, being in a room full of that many lawyers makes me feel important.
Don't be too impressed, Jake said. Most of those guys couldn't try a shoplifting case in city court.
I bet Wade Lanier can, Letty said. He's smooth. I get the impression he knows what I'm going to say before I say it.
He's very good, Jake admitted. Believe me, Letty, we will learn to despise him. He seems to be a nice guy now, but you won't be able to stand the sight of him before this is over. The thought of a long fight seemed to deflate Letty. 4 hours into the initial skirmish, and she was already exhausted. During lunch, two ladies from the clerk's office assembled a small artificial Christmas tree and placed it at the far rear corner of the courtroom. From where Jake was sitting at the table, he had a clear, unobstructed view of the tree. At noon each Christmas Eve, most of the circuit and chancery court clerks and judges, and a few hand-picked lawyers, gathered back there for eggnog and gag gifts. It was a gathering Jake tried his best to avoid. The tree, though, reminded him that Christmas was only days away, and the thought of shopping had not yet crossed his mind, at least not until then. As Wade Lanier plowed ahead in a voice so low and dry that it was practically a sedative, Jake caught his mind drifting away to the holidays. For the past 2 years, they had struggled to decorate their rental and bring it alive for the holidays. Hannah helped tremendously. Having a child around the house kept everyone's spirits up. Lanier moved into a sensitive area. Slowly, skillfully, he probed into Letty's duties around the house when Mr. Hubbard was sick with the chemo and radiation and confined to his bed. Letty explained that a home health care agency sent nurses over to tend him, but these women were not good, not considerate enough, and Mr. Hubbard was quite rude. She didn't blame him. He ran them off and had fights with the agency. Eventually, Letty took over his care. She cooked whatever he wanted and fed him when he needed help. She helped him out of bed and to the bathroom, where he sometimes sat on the toilet for half an hour. He had accidents, and she cleaned his bed. On several occasions, he was forced to use the bedpan, and Letty tended to him. No, it was not pleasant work, and she was not trained in such ways, but she managed. He appreciated her kindness. He trusted her. Yes, on several occasions she bathed Mr. Hubbard in his bed. Yes, a complete bath, touching everywhere. He was so sick and hardly awake. Later, when they stopped the chemo and radiation for a while, he regained his strength and began moving around as soon as possible. He bounced back with an amazing determination. No, he never quit smoking. Intimacy can kill our case, Jake had explained to Portia in blunt terms, which were then filtered through daughter to mother. If the jury believes Letty got too close to Seth Hubbard, they'll have no trouble finding she unduly influenced him. Was Mr. Hubbard affectionate with her? Was he one to hug, peck on the cheek, pat on the rear end? Not in the least, Letty said. Never. Her boss was a hard man who kept to himself. He had little patience with other people and needed few friends. He did not shake Letty's hand when she arrived for work in the morning, nor did he offer her even a semblance of an embrace when saying goodbye. She was his employee, nothing more. Not a friend, nor a confidant, nor anything else. He was polite, and he thanked her when appropriate, but he was never a man of many words. She knew nothing of his business, nor his social affairs. He never spoke of another woman, and Letty never saw one in his home. In fact, she could not remember a single incident when a friend or business acquaintance came to the house. Not in the 3 years she worked there. Perfect, Jake said to himself. Bad lawyers try to trick witnesses, or pin them down, or confuse them, all in an effort to win the deposition. Good lawyers preferred to win at trial, and used depositions as a means to gather information that could be used to set traps later. Great lawyers skipped depositions altogether and orchestrated beautiful ambushes in front of the jury. Wade Lanier and Stillman Rush were good lawyers, and they spent the first day collecting data. During 8 hours of direct examination, there was not the first cross word, not the first hint of disrespect for the witness. Jake was impressed with his opponents. Later in his office, he explained to Letty and Portia that both Lanier and Rush were basically acting. They were presenting themselves as friendly guys who really liked Letty and were just searching for the truth. They wanted Letty to like them, to trust them, so that at the trial she might drop her guard. "They're a couple of wolves," he said. "At trial, they'll go for your throat." Letty, exhausted, asked,
"Jake, I won't be on the stand for no 8 hours, will I?"
"You'll be ready." She had her doubts. Zach Zeitler led off the following morning with a series of probing questions about Mr. Hubbard's last days. He struck pay dirt when he asked,
"Did you see him on Saturday, October 1st?
Jake braced himself for what would follow. He had known it for several days, but there was no way to avoid it. The truth was the truth.
"I did,"
Letty answered.
"I thought you said you never worked on Saturdays." "That's right. But Mr. Hubbard asked me to come in that Saturday."
"And why was that?"
"He wanted me to go to his office with him to clean it. The regular guy was off sick and the place needed cleaning."
Around the table, Letty's response was far more effective than the morning coffee. Eyes opened, spines stiffened, rear ends inched to the edges of chairs. A couple of telling glances were exchanged. Smelling blood, Zeitler pressed on cautiously.
"What time did you arrive at Mr. Hubbard's house?"
"Around 9 that morning."
"And what did he say?"
"He said he wanted me to go with him to his office. So we got in the car and went to his office."
"Which car?"
"His, the Cadillac."
"Who drove?"
"I did. Mr. Hubbard asked me if I'd ever driven a new Cadillac. I said no. I had said something earlier about how nice the car was, and so he asked me if I wanted to drive it. At first I said no, but he handed me the keys, so I drove it over to the office. I was a nervous wreck."
You drove him over?
Zeitler repeated. Around the table, all heads were low as the lawyers scribbled furiously, their minds spinning. In perhaps the most famous will contest in the history of the state, the beneficiary, who was not a blood relative, actually drove the dying person to the lawyer's office to sign a will that cut out all family and left everything to the beneficiary, the driver. The Supreme Court invalidated the last will on the grounds of undue influence and gave as a significant reason the fact that the surprise beneficiary had been so involved in the making of the new will. Since that court decision 30 years earlier, it was not unusual for a lawyer to ask, "Who drove him over?" when an unexpected will was discovered.
"Yes," she said.
Jake watched the other eight lawyers as they reacted exactly as he anticipated. It was a gift to them and a hurdle for him to clear. Zeitler carefully arranged some notes, then said,
"How long were you in his office?"
"I didn't look at no clock, but I say a couple of hours."
"Who else was there?"
"No one. He said they usually didn't work on Saturdays, at least not in the office."
"I see."
For the next hour, Zeitler probed through that Saturday morning. He asked Letty to draw a diagram of the office building to establish where she cleaned and where Mr. Hubbard spent the time. She said he never left his office and the door was shut. No, she did not go in there, not even to clean. She did not know what he was working on or what he was doing in his office. He came and went with his everyday briefcase, but she had no idea what was in it. He appeared to be clear-headed, certainly able to drive if he had wanted, and she knew little about his pain medications. Yes, he was frail and weak, but he had gone to the office every day that week. If anyone else saw them at the office, she was not aware of it. Yes, she drove the Cadillac back to Mr. Hubbard's house. Then she went home, arriving there around noon.
"And he never mentioned the fact that he was writing his last will?"
"Objection," Jake said. "She's already answered that twice."
"Okay, yes. Well, I just wanted to make sure."
"It's in the record."
"Sure."
Having scored big, Zeitler was reluctant to move on. He established that Letty drove the Cadillac on that day only. She rarely saw pill bottles or drugs around the house. She suspected he kept his meds in his briefcase. At times, he was in severe pain. He never talked about suicide. She never witnessed bizarre behavior that would suggest he was under the influence of medications. He was not a drinker, but occasionally kept a few beers in the refrigerator, and he kept a desk in his bedroom, but almost never worked at home. By noon Tuesday, Letty was ready to quit. She had a long lunch in Jake's office again with Portia, then took a nap on a sofa. Death by deposition continued on Wednesday as Jake took charge and quizzed Herschel Hubbard for several hours. The morning session dragged on with stultifying dullness, and it didn't take long to establish that Herschel had accomplished little and taken few chances in his career. His divorce had been the most exciting event in his life. Such hot topics as his education, work experiences, businesses, former homes and apartments, relationships, friends, interests, hobbies, religious convictions, and political leanings were covered in depth and proved to be stunningly boring. Several of the attorneys nodded off. Portia, in her third day of real legal action, struggled to stay awake. After lunch, the lawyers reluctantly returned to the courtroom for another session. Jake managed to liven things up a bit when he began trying to pin down how much time Herschel had spent with his father in the past several years. Herschel tried to give the impression he and the old man were close, but had trouble recalling specific visits. If they spoke so often on the phone, what might the phone records reveal? Jake asked. Any cards and letters from Seth? Herschel was sure he had them, but he wasn't so sure he could produce them. His lawyers had instructed him to be as vague as possible, and he succeeded beautifully. On the subject of Letty Lang, Herschel claimed to have been around her quite often during his many visits to see his beloved father. In his opinion, Seth was quite fond of her. He admitted he never saw them touch in any way, but there was something in the way they looked at each other. What, exactly? Not sure, but just something between them. She was always listening, always in the shadows trying to eavesdrop, and as his father got sicker, he depended more and more on Letty, and they grew closer. Jake asked if he was suggesting they were intimate.
Only Letty knows that, Herschel replied, implying, of course, the obvious.
Portia fumed as she glanced around the table. She assumed that every person there, except for Jake, believed her mother was sleeping with a withered and decaying old white man, and doing so to get his money. But Portia kept her head low, and as a professional, maintained a poker face as she filled another page with notes that would never be reviewed. 7 hours of probing were more than enough to establish Herschel Hubbard was a less than interesting person who'd had a strained and distant relationship with his father. He was still living with his mother, still reeling from a bad divorce, and at the age of 46, barely surviving on the income from a student hangout. What Herschel desperately needed was an inheritance. As did Ramona. Her deposition kicked off at 9 on Thursday morning, and by then the lawyers were cranky and fed up with the case. Spending 5 consecutive days in deposition was a rare event, though not unheard of. During a break, Wade Lanier told a story of deposing a dozen consecutive witnesses over 10 straight days in an oil spill case in New Orleans. The witnesses were from Venezuela, most did not speak English, and the interpreters were not that fluent. The lawyers partied hard every night, suffered through the depositions with awful hangovers, and 2 of them entered rehab when the ordeal was over. No one had more stories than Wade Lanier. He was the senior lawyer and had spent 30 years in courtrooms. The more Jake watched and listened, the more he respected Lanier. He would be a formidable foe before the jury. Ramona turned out to be as dull as her brother. From their depositions, it slowly became apparent that Seth Hubbard was a neglectful father who viewed his children as little more than nuisances. In hindsight, and with the money on the line, they tried valiantly to prop up the old guy and make them all seem like a close, happy family. But Seth simply could not be reinvented. Jake poked and prodded and trapped her here and there, but he did so with a smile and tried not to offend her. Since she and Herschel spent so little time with their father, their testimony would not be that crucial at trial. They were not around him in the days before his death. Thus, they had nothing to offer on the subject of his mental capacity. They had no first-hand knowledge of his alleged closeness to Letty. And these were only preliminary depositions. Jake and the other lawyers knew that in all likelihood, Letty, Herschel, Ramona, and Ian Defoe would be deposed again. When the facts became clearer and the issues more narrowly defined, the lawyers would have more questions. Chapter 23. Leaving the courthouse in a hurry late Thursday afternoon, Jake was grabbed by Stillman Rush, who asked if he had time for a quick drink. It was a strange offer because the two had nothing in common except the Hubbard case. Sure, he said, why not? Stillman had something important to talk about. Otherwise, he wouldn't waste his time with a street lawyer like Jake. They met in a bar in the basement of an old building just off the square, walking distance from the courthouse. It was already dark outside and misting, a perfectly gloomy evening and a great time for a drink. Though Jake didn't frequent bars, he had been there before. It was a shadowy, damp place with dark corners and booths, and gave the impression that semi-legitimate deals were going down. Bobby Carl Leach, the town's most infamous shyster, owned a table next to the fireplace and was often seen there with politicians and bankers. Harry Rex Vonner was a regular. Jake and Stillman got a booth, ordered draft beers, and began to unwind. After four straight days at the same table listening to endless and marginally useful testimony, they were almost numb with tedium. Stillman's innate cockiness seemed to vanish, and he was almost likable. When the waiter dropped off the beers, he leaned in low and said, "Here's an idea, just me thinking with no authority from anyone else, but there's a pile of money here. We all know that. Not sure how much right now, but 24 million, Jake interrupted. The lawyers would soon learn what was in the inventory, and there was no harm in revealing this to Stillman. Jake was just trying to keep it out of the newspapers. Stillman paused, smiled, took a sip, and shook his head. 24 million. And no debts. Hard to believe, isn't it?
It is.
So there's 24 million, and by the time the tax collectors have their way, we'll be lucky if half of it's left.
Jake said, "That's right, according to the accountants."
So we're down to 12 million, still a lot of money, more than you and I will ever see. So here's my idea, Jake. Why don't we try and negotiate a settlement? There are three main players, Herschel, Ramona, and Letty. Surely we can slice the pie and make everyone happy.
It was not an original idea. Jake and Lucian had kicked it around several times, and they were certain the opposing lawyers had done the same. Each side gives a little or a lot, cut off the attorney's fees and expenses, stop the presses, avoid the stress and uncertainty of a trial, and everybody is guaranteed a nice slice of the pie. It made perfect sense. In every lawsuit, the potential of a settlement was always in the minds of the attorneys.
"Is this what your client wants to do?" Jake asked.
"I don't know. We haven't discussed it yet. But if it's a possibility, then I'll approach Herschel and lean on him."
"Okay, this pie you're talking about, how do you want to slice it?"
A long gulp followed by a backhand wipe of the mouth, and Stillman lunged onward. "Let's be honest, Jake. Letty Lang is entitled to very little. In the scheme of things, and in the normal transition of assets and estates, she just doesn't figure in. She's not family, and regardless of how screwed up a family might be, the money almost always gets handed down to the next generation. You know that. 90% of all money that flows through wills goes to family members. 90% in Mississippi, same in New York and California, where they have, shall we say, bigger estates. And look at the law. If a person dies with no will, then all money and assets go to blood kin and no one else. Keeping the money in the family is preferred by the law."
"True. But we can't settle this case if Letty is told she gets nothing."
"Of course not, Jake. Give her a couple of million. Can you imagine that? Letty Lang, unemployed, a career housekeeper, suddenly walks away with $2 million, and that's after taxes. I'm not denigrating the woman, Jake. Hell, I came to like her during the deposition. She's pleasant, even funny, a good person. I'm not being critical of her. But come on, Jake. Do you know how many black people in Mississippi are worth seven figures?"
"Enlighten me."
"According to the 1980 census,
7 black folks in this state claimed to be worth more than $1 million. All men, most were in construction or real estate. Letty would be the richest black woman in the state.
And your client and his sister split the remaining $10 million, Jake asked.
Something like that. Give a nice gift to the church, and we'll split the rest.
That would be a good deal for you guys, Jake said. You'll rake off a third of almost $5 million. Not a bad payday.
I didn't say we're getting a third, Jake.
But you're getting a percentage.
I can't say. But sure, it'll be a nice payday.
For some, thought Jake. If the case settled now, his fees would be severely reined in. Have you discussed this with Wade Lanier? Stillman grimaced at the mention of his name.
That's another story. Lanier wants my client, who, for now, is sticking with me. I don't trust Lanier, and I'll spend the next 6 months looking over my shoulder.
What a snake. So the answer is no.
The answer is no. I haven't discussed it with anyone.
I take it things are tense between your client and his client.
I suppose. Herschel and Ramona can get along when they have to, but Ian is the problem. Herschel said he and Ian can't stand one another, never have. He sees Ian as a privileged little prick from a stuffy old family that managed to lose it all, and so he's trying hard to regain some status and play the big shot. He's always looked down on the Hubbards as something slightly above white trash, until now, of course. Now he's suddenly enamored with the family and has deep concerns for its well-being.
It was not lost on Jake that Stillman referred to someone else as a privileged little prick from a stuffy old family.
What a surprise, he said. Look, Stillman, I just spent 8.5 hours playing pitch and catch with Ramona, and if I didn't know better, I'd say the woman drinks too much. The red, leaky eyes, the puffiness partially hidden under makeup, the extra layer of wrinkles that seem too much for a woman of only 42. I'm an expert on drunks because I'm close to Lucien Wilbanks.
Herschel says she's a lush who's been threatening to leave Ian for years, Stillman said, and Jake was impressed with his candor.
Now she can't run him off, Jake said.
Oh, no. I think Ian is once again madly in love with his wife. I have a pal in Jackson who knows some of Ian's drinking buddies. They say he likes the ladies.
I'll ask him about it tomorrow.
Do that. The point is, Herschel and Ian will never trust each other.
They ordered more beers and finished off their first round. Stillman said,
"You don't seem too excited about the prospects of a settlement."
You're ignoring what the old man wanted. He was very clear, both in his will and in his letter to me. He directed me to defend his handwritten will at all costs, to the bitter end.
He directed you?
Yes, in a letter that accompanied the will. You'll see it later. He was very specific in his desire to cut out his family.
But he's dead.
It's still his money. How can we redirect his money when his wishes were quite clear? It's not right, and I doubt if Judge Attlee would approve it.
And if you lose?
Then I'll lose doing what I was directed to do, defend the will at all costs. The second beers arrived just as Harry Rex lumbered by without speaking. He seemed preoccupied and did not look at Jake. It was not yet 6 p.m., too early for Harry Rex to leave the office. He crawled into a booth by himself in a corner and tried to hide. Stillman wiped foam from his mouth again and asked,
"Why'd he do it, Jake? Any clues so far?"
"Not really," Jake said with a shrug, as though he would honestly share inside dirt with his opponent. He wouldn't give Stillman Rush the time of day if it could possibly help his cause.
"Sex?"
Another casual shrug, a quick shake of the head, a frown.
"I don't think so.
The old guy was 71. a heavy smoker, sick, frail, eaten up with cancer. It's hard to imagine him having the energy and stamina to get it on with any woman.
He wasn't sick 2 years ago.
True, but there's no way to prove it. I'm not talking about proof, Jake, or evidence or trials or anything else. I'm just speculating. There's got to be a reason.
Then figure it out yourself, asshole, Jake thought, but didn't say. He was amused at Stillman's clumsy effort at gossip, as if the two were old drinking buddies who often shared secrets. Loose lips sink ships, Harry Rex was fond of saying. Loose lips lose lawsuits. Jake said, "It's hard to believe a little sex could be worth $24 million." Stillman laughed and said,
"Not so sure.
Wars have been fought over it."
"True. No interest in pursuing a settlement?"
"Nah. I have my marching orders."
"You'll be sorry."
"Is that a threat?"
"Not at all. The way we see it, Booker Sistrunk has already pissed off every white person in Ford County."
"Didn't know you were such an expert on Ford County."
"Look, Jake, you got one huge sensational verdict here. Don't let it go to your head."
"I wasn't looking for advice."
"Maybe you need it.
From you?"
Stillman drained his mug and sat it hard on the table.
"Gotta run. I'll pay at the bar."
He was already out of the booth and reaching into a pocket. Jake watched him leave, cursed him, then eased deeper into the room and slid into the booth opposite Harry Rex.
"Sitting among your friends?" Jake asked.
"Well, well. So Carla let you out of the house?"
Harry Rex was working on a Bud Light and reading a magazine, which he put aside. "I just had my first and last drink with Stillman Rush."
"How thrilling. Let me guess. He wants to settle."
"How'd you know?"
"Figures. A quick deal and those boys make out like bandits."
Jake described Stillman's version of a fair settlement, and they had a good laugh. A waiter delivered a platter of nachos and dip.
"Is this your dinner?" Jake asked.
"No, this is high tea. I'm headed back to the office. You'll never guess who's in town."
"Who?"
"Remember Willie Traynor? Used to own the Times?"
"Sort of. I met him once or twice, years ago. Seems like he sold the paper about the time I arrived here."
"That's right. Willie bought it in 1970 from the Caudill family. It was in bankruptcy, and I think he paid something like $50,000 for it. Sold it 10 years later for $1.5 million.
Harry Rex loaded up a nacho and stuffed it in his mouth. Pausing only slightly, he continued,
"He never really fit in around here, so he went back to Memphis, where he was from, and lost his ass in real estate. Then his grandmother died and left him another bundle. He's in the process of losing it, too, I think. We were pretty close back in the day, and he pops in from time to time looking for a drink."
"Does he still own the Hocut house?"
"Yep. And I think that's one reason he wants to talk. He bought it in 1972 after all the Hocuts died off. Talk about a weird bunch. Twins, Wilma and Gilma, plus a brother and a crazy sister, and none of them ever married. Willie bought the house because nobody else wanted it. Then he spent a few years fixing it up. You ever seen it?"
"Only from the street. It's beautiful."
"It's one of the finest Victorians in these parts. Kind of reminds me of your old place, just a lot bigger. Willie has good taste, and the interior is immaculate. Problem is, he hasn't spent 3 nights there in the past 5 years. He wants to sell it. Probably needs the money. But hell, can't nobody around here afford it."
"Whatever the price, it's way out of my range," Jake said.
"He thinks it's worth $300,000. I said maybe so, but he'll never get it. Not now, not 10 years from now.
Some doctor will buy it."
"He mentioned you, Jake. He followed the Haley trial, knows all about the Klan burning your house. He knows you're in the market."
"I'm not in the market, Harry Rex.
I'm in litigation with the insurance company. But tell him thanks anyway. Too rich for my blood.
You want some nachos?
No, thanks. I need to get home.
Tell Carla I love her and lust after her body.
She knows it. Later. Jake walked to his office in a cold drizzle. The street lamps around the square were adorned with Christmas wreaths and silver bells. Carols rang out from a nativity scene in front of the courthouse. The merchants were open late, and the stores were busy. There was a slight chance of snow tomorrow, and few things excited the town like such a forecast. The old-timers claimed there had been a white Christmas in 1952, and even the slightest chance of one now had kids staring out of windows and stores offering shovels and salt. Shoppers scurried about with great anticipation, as if a blizzard was expected. Jake took the long route home, driving slowly away from the square and into the shaded streets of central Clanton, until he turned onto Market Street. A light was on in the Hocut House, a rarity. Jake and Carla had passed it many times, always slowly, admiringly, and always aware that the lovely Victorian was hardly used. There had always been rumors that Willie Traynor was selling the place. He had abandoned Clanton after he sold the paper, and everyone knew it. The house needed painting. In the summer, the flower beds were choked with weeds, and the grass was rarely mowed. In the fall, the leaves gathered in drifts on the front porch, and no one raked them. For a moment, Jake was tempted to stop, knock on the door, barge in, have a drink with Willie, and talk business. But the temptation passed, and he headed home. Chapter 24. On the morning of Christmas Eve, Jake slept late, or as late as possible. With Carla dead to the world, he eased out of bed at 7 and without a sound went to the kitchen. He brewed coffee, scrambled eggs, and toasted muffins, and when he returned with breakfast in bed, she grudgingly came to life. They were eating slowly and talking quietly, thoroughly enjoying a rare moment, when Hannah bounded into the room, full of anticipation and chattering nonstop about Santa Claus. She wedged herself between her parents and helped herself to a muffin. Without prompting, she reviewed everything she had put in her letter to the North Pole and seemed genuinely concerned that she might be asking for too much. Both parents patiently disagreed. She was, after all, the only child and usually got what she wanted. Plus, there was a surprise that would overshadow all of her requests. An hour later, Jake and Hannah left for the square while Carla stayed home to wrap packages. Roxy was off for the day, and Jake needed to retrieve a gift for his wife. The office was always the best hiding place. He expected to find no one there, but was not too surprised when he saw Lucian in the conference room, digging through a stack of old files. He looked as though he had been there for hours, and more important, he looked clean and sober.
"We need to talk," he said.
Hannah loved to rummage through her father's big office, so Jake turned her loose upstairs and went to find coffee. Lucian had already consumed half a pot and seemed sufficiently wired.
"You're not going to believe this," he said as he closed the conference room door.
Jake fell into a chair, stirred his coffee, and asked, "Can this wait until Monday?"
"No, shut up and listen. The great question here is, why would a man do what Seth Hubbard did, right? Make a last-minute will, crude and handwritten, cut out his family, and leave everything to a person who has no claim to any of his fortune. This is the question that haunts you now, and it will only get bigger until we find the answer."
"Assuming there is an answer."
"Yes. So to unravel this mystery and to hopefully help you win this case, we have to answer that question."
"And you've found it?"
"Not yet, but I'm on the trail."
Lucian waved at a pile of debris on the table. Files, copies of old deeds, notes. I have examined the land records of the 200 acres Seth Hubbard owned in this county when he died. A lot of the records were destroyed when the courthouse burned after the Second War, but I've been able to reconstruct much of what I'm looking for. I've dug through every deed book all the way back to the early 1800s, and I've scoured every copy of the local newspapers from the day they started printing. I've also done a fair amount of genealogical research into the Hubbard, Tabor, and Rhines families. As you know, it's very difficult with these black folks. Letty was raised by Cypress and Clyde Tabor, but she was never legally adopted. She didn't know it until she was 30 years old, according to Portia. Portia also believes, as do I, that Letty was really a Rhines, a family that no longer exists in Ford County.
Jake took a sip of coffee and listened intently. Lucian propped up a large hand-drawn map and began pointing.
This is the original Hubbard property, 80 acres, been in the family for 100 years. Seth inherited it from his father, Cleon, who died 30 years ago. Cleon left a will giving everything to Seth, and Ansel was never mentioned. Next to it is another 80-acre section, right here, at the bridge where they found Seth after he fell off his ladder. The other 40 acres over here were purchased by Seth 20 years ago and are not important.
Lucian was tapping the second parcel, upon which he had crudely drawn a creek, a bridge, and a hanging tree.
Here's where it gets interesting. This second tract of 80 acres was purchased in 1930 by Cleon Hubbard. It was sold to him by Sylvester Rhines, or the wife of Sylvester Rhines. The land had been in the Rhines family for 60 years. What's unusual about this is that Rhines was black, and it appears as though his father was the son of a freed slave who took possession of the 80 acres around 1870 during Reconstruction. It's not clear how he managed to assume ownership, and I'm convinced we'll never know. The records simply did not exist.
How did Cleon take ownership from Rhines? Jake asked.
By a simple quitclaim deed signed by Esther Rhines, not by her husband.
Where was her husband?
Don't know. I'm assuming he was either dead or gone because the land was in his name, not his wife's. For her to be able to convey property, it would have been necessary for her to inherit the land. So he was probably dead.
No record of his death?
None yet, but I'm still digging. There's more. There are no records of the Rhines family in Ford County after 1930. They disappeared, and there's not a single Rhines to be found today. I've checked phone books, voter registration records, tax rolls, you name it, and I've been through it. Not a single Rhines anywhere. Pretty unusual.
So?
So they vanished.
Maybe they all went to Chicago like everybody else.
Perhaps. From Letty's deposition, we learned that her mother was about 16 when she was born, out of wedlock, and that she never knew her father. She says she was born near Caledonia, down in Monroe County. Her mother died a couple of years later. Letty doesn't remember her, and an aunt took her in. Then another aunt. Then she finally landed over in Alabama with the Tabor family. She took their last name and got on with life. You heard the rest of it in her deposition. She's never had a birth certificate.
What's the point here, Lucian? He opened another file and slid a copy of a single sheet of paper across the table.
A lot of Negro babies were born back then without birth certificates. They were born at home with midwives and such, and nobody bothered with record keeping. But the health department in every county tried to at least record the births. That's a copy from a page in the 1941 Register of Live Births. It shows one Letitia Dolores Rhines being born on May 16th to a young woman named Lois Rhines, age 16, in Monroe County, Mississippi.
You went to Monroe County and dug this up?
I did, and I'm not finished. Looks like Letty might be a Rhines.
But she said she doesn't remember any of this, or at least she doesn't remember anything before her childhood in Alabama.
Do you remember anything that happened before you were 3 years old?
Everything.
Then you're a nutcase.
So, what if Letty's people came from Ford County?
Let's assume they did, just for the hell of it. And let's assume further that they once owned the same 80 acres that Cleon Hubbard took title to in 1930, the same that got handed down to Seth Hubbard, and the same he willed to Letty. That closes the circle, doesn't it?
Maybe. Maybe not. There are still some huge gaps. You can't assume that all black folks named Rhines in North Mississippi came from Ford County. That's a stretch.
Granted, it's only a theory, but we're making progress.
We?
Portia and I. I've got her digging through her family tree. She's been hounding Cypress for details, but she's not too talkative. And like most families, there's a lot of crap back there that Portia wishes she'd never found.
For example,
Cypress and Clyde Tabor never married. They had 6 kids and lived together for 40 years, but never tied the knot, legally anyway.
That was not unusual. The common law protected them.
I know that. There's a good chance that Cypress is not even blood kin. Portia thinks her mom might have been abandoned more than once before getting dumped on the Tabor's front doorstep.
Does Letty talk about it?
Not much, evidently. As you might guess, her family tree is not a pleasant subject.
Wouldn't Letty know if she was born a Rhines?
One would think so, but maybe not. She was 30 years old before Cypress told her the truth about being adopted. In fact, Cypress never met Letty's mother. Think about that, Jake. For the first 30 years of her life, she assumed Cypress and Clyde were her biological parents, and the other 6 kids were her brothers and sisters. Portia said she was upset when she finally learned the truth, but she's never had any desire to dig into the past. The Tabors in Alabama are not even remotely related to the Rhineses in Ford County, so I guess it's possible Letty doesn't know where she came from.
Jake thought about this for a few minutes as he sipped coffee slowly and tried to think of all the angles. He said, "Okay, let's buy into your theory. Why, then, would Seth want to return the land to a Rhines?"
My theory hasn't gotten that far yet.
And why would he leave her everything? The 80 acres plus a hell of a lot more, at the expense of his own family.
Still digging for that one.
I like it. Let's keep digging.
This could be crucial, Jake, because it could prove motive. The big question is, why? And if we can answer it, then you might just win at trial. Otherwise, you're screwed.
That's just your opinion, Lucian. As I recall, that was your general sentiment right before the Haley trial.
The sooner you forget that trial, the sooner you'll become a better lawyer.
Jake smiled and stood. Some things you can't forget, Lucian. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go shopping with my daughter. Merry Christmas to you.
Bah, humbug.
Are you coming over for dinner?
Bah, humbug.
That's what I figured. See you Monday. Simeon Lang arrived home just after dark on Christmas Eve. He had been away for over 2 weeks, and his travels had taken him as far as Oregon, in an 18-wheeler packed with 6 tons of stolen appliances. He had a pocket full of cash, love in his heart, Christmas jingles on his tongue, and a nice bottle of bourbon hidden under the passenger seat. He was cold sober at the moment, and he was promising himself he would not let the booze disrupt the holidays. All in all, Simeon was in a cheerful mood, at least until he pulled to a stop in front of the old Sappington place. He counted 7 cars parked haphazardly in the driveway and around the front lawn. 3 he recognized, the others he wasn't so sure. He abruptly stopped Jingle Bells in mid-chorus and wanted to curse. All the lights were on in the house, and it gave every impression of being filled with people. One of the advantages of marrying Letty was that her family lived far away, over in Alabama. She had no relatives in Ford County. On his side, there were too many, and they caused trouble, but he took no flack from her people, at least not in the early years. He had secretly been delighted when she, at the age of 30, learned that Cypress and Clyde Tabor were not her real parents, and their 6 kids were not her siblings. This delight faded quickly, though, when Letty carried on as if they were blood kin. Clyde died, the kids scattered, and Cypress needed a place to live. They took her in, temporarily, and 5 years later, she was still there, bigger and needier than ever. The brothers and sisters were back, with their broods in tow and their hands out. To be fair, there were some Langs in there, too. A sister-in-law in particular had become a constant nuisance. She was out of work and needed a loan, preferably one accompanied by a verbal promise that could not be enforced. Simeon almost reached for the bottle, but he fought the urge and got out of his truck. There were kids everywhere, a fire in the fireplace, and a kitchen full of women cooking and men tasting. Almost everyone was either happy to see him or good at pretending. Letty smiled and they hugged. He had called the day before from Kansas and promised to be home in time for dinner. She pecked him on the cheek to see if he had been drinking, and when he passed that test, she relaxed considerably. To her knowledge, there was not a drop of booze in the house, and she wanted desperately to keep it that way. In the den, Simeon hugged his kids, Portia, Phaedra, Clarice, and Kirk, and his 2 grandchildren. From upstairs, a boombox was blasting Rudolph, while 3 little boys pushed Cypress in her wheelchair up and down the hallway at a dangerous speed. Teenagers watched the television at full volume. The old house almost shook with a chaotic energy, and after a few minutes, Simeon was at peace again. The solitude of the open road had been dashed, but it was, after all, Christmas Eve, and he was surrounded by family. For sure, much of the love and warmth on display was being driven by greed and the desire to get closer to Letty, but Simeon let it go. For a few hours anyway, just enjoy the moment. If only Marvis could be there. Letty arranged 2 tables end-to-end in the dining room. The ladies then covered them with roasted turkeys, hams, sweet potatoes, 6 other vegetables and casseroles, and an impressive assortment of cakes and pies. It took a few minutes to gather everyone around the food, and when they were still, Letty offered a quick prayer of thanksgiving. But she had more to say. She unfolded a sheet of white notebook paper and said, "Please listen. This is from Marvis." At the sound of his name, all movement stopped. All heads dipped lower. They all had their own memories of the oldest child, and most of them were heartbreaking, unpleasant. Letty read,
"Hello, Mom and Dad, brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, aunts and uncles, cousins and friends. I wish you the happiest holiday greetings and hope everyone has a Merry Christmas. I'm writing this from my cell at night. From here I can catch a glimpse of the sky, and tonight there is no moon but plenty of stars. One is really bright. I think it's the North Star, but I'm not sure. Anyway, right now, I'm pretending it's the star over Bethlehem, leading the wise men to the baby Jesus. Matthew chapter 2. I love you all. I wish I could be there. I'm so sorry for my mistakes and the misery I've caused to my family and friends. I'll get out one day, and when I'm free, I'll be there at Christmas, and we'll have a great time. Marvis.
Her voice stayed strong, but tears streamed down her cheeks. She wiped them, managed a smile, then said,
"Let's eat."
Because it was a special occasion, Hannah insisted on sleeping with her parents. They read Christmas stories until well past 10, with at least 2 breaks every half hour, so she could sprint to the den and make sure Santa had not somehow sneaked into the house. She chattered and wiggled with usual nervous anticipation until she inadvertently grew still. When Jake awoke at sunrise, she was wedged under her mother, both of them sound asleep. But with a gentle, "I think Santa Claus has been here," his girl sprang to life. Hannah dashed to the tree and squealed with amazement at the glorious loot Santa had left her. Jake made the coffee while Carla took photos. They opened gifts and laughed with Hannah as the wrappings and boxes piled up. What on earth was better than being a 7-year-old on Christmas morning? When the excitement began to wane, Jake stepped away and eased outside. In a small utility room next to the carport, he retrieved another package, a large square box wrapped in green paper with a large red bow. From inside, the puppy whimpered. It had been a long night for both of them. "Look what I found," he announced as he sat the box on the floor next to Hannah.
"What is it, Daddy?"
Hannah asked, immediately suspicious. From inside, the frazzled puppy made not a sound.
"Open it," Carla said,
and Hannah began ripping paper. Jake unfolded the top of the box, and Hannah looked inside. Sadie met her gaze with sad, tired eyes that seemed to say, "Get me out of here." They would pretend Sadie came from the North Pole. In fact, she came from the county's rescue shelter, where for $37 Jake bought her with all shots included and some future spaying thrown in. With hints of pedigree not even remotely possible, her handlers could not speculate on her size or temperament. One thought she had a lot of terrier, while another disagreed sharply and said, "There's got to be some schnauzer in there somewhere." Her mother had been found dead in a ditch, and she and her 5 siblings had been rescued at the age of about 1 month. Hannah lifted her gently, cradled her, cuddled her, squeezed her next to her chest, and of course the dog began licking her face. She looked at her parents in speechless amazement, her beautiful eyes moist, her voice unable to work. Jake said, "Santa called her Sadie, but you can choose any name you want." Santa was a miracle worker, but at that moment, all other gifts and toys he had left behind were instantly forgotten. Hannah finally said,
"Sadie's perfect."
Within an hour, the dog had taken over, as all 3 humans followed her around, making sure she got whatever she wanted. The invitation to cocktails was a handwritten note from Willie Traynor. 6 o'clock, the day after Christmas, at the Hocut House. Holiday attire, whatever that meant. Carla insisted it meant a necktie at the least, and Jake eventually caved in. Initially, they went through the motions of pretending they did not want to go, when in reality there was absolutely nothing else to do on the day after Christmas. Well-done cocktail parties were rare in Clanton, and they suspected Willie, who grew up in Memphis amid money,
might just know how to throw one.
The biggest draw was the house. For years they had admired it from the street, but had never managed to get inside. "There's a rumor he wants to sell it," Jake said as they were discussing the invitation. He had not told his wife about the earlier conversation with Harry Rex, mainly because the price, whatever it happened to be, was far out of their range.
"That rumor has been around, hasn't it?" she replied, and from that moment on began dreaming about the house.
"Yes, but Harry Rex says Willie is serious now. He never stays there."
They were the first to arrive, fashionably late at 10 minutes after, and Willie was all alone. His holiday attire included a red bow tie, black satin dinner jacket, and some modification of Scottish kilts. He was in his early 40s, handsome with long hair and a graying beard, and perfectly charming, especially to Carla. Jake had to admit to some level of envy. Willie was only a few years older, yet he had already made $1 million. He was single, known to enjoy the ladies, and gave the impression of a man who had been around the world. He poured champagne into heavy crystal flutes, offered a holiday toast, and after the first sip said with a smile, "I want to tell you something," as if they were family and important news had arrived. He went on, "I have decided to sell this house. I've owned it for 16 years, and I love the place, but I'm simply not here enough. It needs real owners, people who will treasure it, preserve it, and keep it just like it is." Another sip as Jake and Carla hung in midair. "And I'm not selling to just anyone. No realtor is involved. I'd like to avoid putting it on the market. I don't want the town talking about it." Jake couldn't suppress a chuckle at this. The town was already talking.
Okay, there are no secrets around here, but folks don't have to know what we discuss. I would love for you two to have it. I actually saw your other house before it was destroyed, and I admire the way you restored it."
"Cut the price and we're in," Jake said. Willie looked at Carla's soft brown eyes and said,
"This place has your name written all over it."
"How much?" Jake asked. His spine stiffened and he vowed not to flinch when the figure was revealed.
$250, Willie said without hesitation. "I paid $100 for it in 1972. Then spent $100 more fixing it up. Same house in Midtown Memphis would push $1 million. But then that's a long way off. At $250, it's a steal, but you can't ignore the market. If I advertised it for $500,000, it would sit here until the weeds took over. Frankly, I'd just like to get my money back."
Jake and Carla exchanged blank stares because there was nothing to say, not at that moment. Willie, ever the salesman, said,
"Let's look around. The others get here at 6:30.
He topped off their flutes, and they headed for the front porch. Once the tour commenced, Jake knew there was no turning back. According to Willie, the house was built around 1900 by Dr. Miles Hocutt, the town's leading physician for decades. It was a classic Victorian, with two high-gabled roofs, a turret that ran up four levels, and wide covered porches that swept around the house on both sides. The price was not outrageous, Jake had to admit. It was certainly out of his range, but it could have been much worse. Jake suspected Harry Rex had advised Willie to be reasonable, especially if he wanted the Braganzas to own it. According to Harry Rex, one rumor had Willie making another bundle in the stock market. Another had him losing badly in Memphis real estate, and yet another had him inheriting a fortune from his grandmother, Bibi. Who knew? The price, though, seemed to indicate a need for quick cash. Willie knew Jake and Carla needed a house. He knew they were bogged down in insurance litigation. He knew, probably through Harry Rex, that Jake was in line to collect a generous fee in the Hubbard matter. As Willie chatted nonstop and guided Carla across the beautifully stained heart pine floors, through the modern kitchen, up the winding staircase, and all the way into the circular reading room on the fourth level of the turret, with a view of the church steeples just blocks away, Jake dutifully followed along, wondering how in the world they could possibly afford it, let alone furnish it. Chapter 25. For those contesting the handwritten will of Seth Hubbard, Christmas came late, January 16th to be exact. An investigator working for Wade Lanier struck gold. His name was Randall Clapp, and he finally found a potential witness named Fritz Pickering, who was living near Shreveport, Louisiana. Clapp was Wade Lanier's top investigator and had a well-trained nose for digging up information. Pickering was simply minding his own business and had no idea what Clapp wanted. But he was curious, so they agreed to meet at a delicatessen where Clapp said he'd buy lunch. Clapp was in the process of interviewing Letty Lang's former employers, almost all of whom were fairly affluent white homeowners accustomed to using black domestic help. In her deposition, Letty had given as many of these names as she could remember, or so she testified. She was clear that there might have been one or two others over the past 30 years. She didn't keep records. Most housekeepers did not. She had failed, though, to mention working for Irene Pickering. The name surfaced when Clapp was interviewing another former boss. Letty had never worked for anyone longer than 6 years. There were various reasons for this, none of which had anything to do with incompetence. Indeed, almost all of her ex-employers gave her high marks. Pickering, though, would be different. Over soup and salad, he told his story. About 10 years earlier, either in 1978 or 1979, his mother, a widow named Irene Pickering, had hired Letty Lang to clean and cook. Mrs. Pickering lived just outside the small town of Lake Village in an old house that had been in the family forever. At the time, Fritz Pickering lived in Tupelo and worked for an insurance company, the one that transferred him to Shreveport. He saw his mother at least once a month and came to know Letty fairly well. Everyone was pleased with the relationship, especially Mrs. Pickering. In 1980, her health began a rapid decline, and it became obvious that the end was near.